A podcast of the cinema, hosted by...
What was all the racketing? What's all the racketizing going on out there?
It's, as they say in Silent Night, Deadly Night 2, it's garbage day.
Oh, is it? It is? Okay. It seems like every day is garbage day.
Doesn't it?
It seems like we have garbage trucks all the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like, I know that dumpster day isn't the same as recycling day, but you're right. It does seem like a daily...
Recycling day is Friday, I think. Well, we're ready. You took the recycling down earlier.
I did.
This morning. Citizen Alonzo.
Well, look, most recycling is jive.
Right.
But paper, glass, aluminum, that still gets recycled, I think.
Oh, okay.
It's not like plastic where it turns out we weren't really recycling it. We were just selling it to China. And then China finally said, you know what? We're good. Don't want anymore. Thanks.
We've got all we need.
Yeah.
Everyone has all they need of plastic.
Apparently so.
Yeah.
The Pacific Ocean has more than it needs, apparently.
The name of this podcast is Linoleum Knife.
Yes.
We are film critics. We talk about movies.
Mm-hmm.
The current cinema.
Yes.
My name is Dave White. I'm a film critic. I write for The Wrap. Feels good to say that again.
Oh. Good.
I'm employed again.
You've earned it.
Have I?
Well, you've earned the right to say it because
you're
writing.
I've earned the right to say it. Yeah. I'm going to be even writing another review next week.
That's right.
You're Alonzo Duralde.
Yes.
You are the reviews editor at The Wrap.
Correct.
Also, the lead film critic of that site.
Yes.
You just wrote not an obituary.
An appreciation.
An appreciation of the late director Richard Donner, who just passed away this week.
Yes.
And I guess before you get into that, I know you want to talk about... We often don't talk about the people who died during the week.
Yeah, it's hard
even
to
if
keep
they're
up.
Like, even if they were superstars, like,
right.
We tend not to because A, we forget. B, we would be talking about a fresh dead person every week. So, so before we get into you wanting to talk about Richard Donner, I need to list your other accomplishments. You currently co-host. Some other podcasts. The names are, hang on.
You can do this.
Maximum Film.
Yes.
On the Maximum Fun Network.
Correct. Breakfast All Day.
Breakfast All Day on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
With Matt and Christy, formerly known as What the Flick.
Right. And then Mondays.
Mondays. Now, I thought you were fixing to start doing 2 days a week.
No, we've been doing two episodes at a time to work ahead, but it's on once a week.
Oh, now I'm confused. Deck the Hallmark.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'll explain later. It's not interesting. I wrote up a thing about Richard Donner yesterday, and it reminded me, I didn't talk about this in the piece, but I think that Superman the movie was the first film that I was really jazzed to see in advance.
What do you mean? In advance?
Well, just in terms of like a thing that was
You see things in advance all the time now.
No,
it's your job.
That's not what I'm talking about.
What are you talking about?
I meant that in advance, I was jazzed to see it.
In advance of its release,
yes.
You, the child,
yes.
Were excited to see the film.
Correct.
You were anticipating it. You were waiting for it.
Yes.
You were excited.
Yes.
You knew it was coming.
Mm-hmm. Like, there had been, you know, like Star Wars, I don't remember hearing a lot about before it opened when I was 10. Like,
okay.
I sort of knew it was out there, and then it opened, and people were talking about it, and then I ran out to see it.
I remember, hang on. Star Wars came out in, for me, the summer between 7th and 8th grade.
Right.
And, you know, I used to get those little current events handouts, maybe like Scholastic put them out or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like little freebie things. They're like 2-3 pages. And your teacher would hand them out to you and you were expected to...
Like the weekly reader, basically.
Read them and talk about whatever the current events were, because it was like a little news thing for like middle school kids. Anyway, they handed us out one just before school let out that had a review of this new movie, Star Wars.
Huh.
And the review was like, well, you know, it's a fun science fiction outer space movie. You know, maybe it'll be the drive-in. You'll go see that, maybe. And these are the phrases from the review that still stick in my mind.
It's very kind of, eh.
Yeah, it was a real sort of like, yeah, you know, you're a kid.
you'll see whatever.
You'll probably like this, I guess. Like, it was not written by a kid, for sure.
Sure.
And I just remember that review thinking, and when it came out that summer, there had been more anticipation for it by the time it came to Roswell, New Mexico.
Right.
And although we did get it, I think, like, opening weekend. I think we got it the same time everybody else. Yeah, it was, there was an excitement for it, but you would have never known about it. That excitement based on that guy reviewing it.
See, I mean, like, look, as a kid, I was obsessive about reading the movie pages. I knew what was going to open on any Friday. Like, I knew when a Disney movie was opening. I knew when whatever dumb thing
I wanted to go. Yeah, because the Wonderful World of Disney used to tell you.
Yes, that too. So, like, I was aware of movies, but Superman the movie was an event.
Right.
That was, like, I remember clipping full-page ads out of the newspaper and putting them up on the wall of my room.
I'm going to interrupt you again. I remember my first event movie, King Kong. The 1976 King Kong, because they were making a big deal about the fact that they had a giant mechanical Kong.
Yes.
Like this shark, like a mechanical shark in Jaws.
No.
They're like, and now we're going to make a big mechanical Kong. And I was so excited about that.
There was a while where like the back page ad of every comic book I read was an ad for King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, when Superman came out.
So continue.
DC Comics pulled out the stops.
Of course.
Just so much coverage in like the regular media, you know, because of Marvel. Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman and stuff.
Right. Real actors.
I think I had like the making of Superman, the movie, the book, maybe even before I saw it. I can't remember, but I know I read it after I saw it.
You were stoked.
Yeah, I was super, super pumped to see this movie. So that was a turning point for me as a kid, of like a film I was excited to see. And obviously it's a movie that exists because of Star Wars. Like in the same way that Jaws made King Kong happen, Star Wars made Superman happen. Like, yeah, this idea of like, oh, people want sort of old-fashioned pulpy cereal. Da, 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 da. But yeah, Donner's career is fascinating because he started out in television. Like he was Martin Ritt's assistant.
All right.
And then went on to do like commercials and then directed like Wanted Dead or Alive. And, you know, he did the Nightmare at 20,000 Feet episode of The Twilight Zone. You know, the Monster on the Wing with William Shatner. That George Miller would later recreate in 1983's Twilight Zone, the movie with John Lithgow. And then, you know, he had done some earlier films along the way. Like, you know, he did Salt and Pepper with Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter Lawford.
Right.
But his big breakout was The Omen. He did Sarah T. Portrait of a Teenage Alcoholic.
Yeah.
Which was one of those TV movies that everybody was talking about at school the next day. But yes, then he did The Omen and then Superman and the Lethal Weapon movies, The Goonies, which I've still never seen.
Right.
So, you know, I put him in that category of like, nobody would call him an auteur. You know, he's not that kind of filmmaker, like if making popular entertainments was easy, everyone would do it. So clearly he was good at it.
Yeah. Well. Making popular entertainment seemingly is easy because you've got the career of Dennis Dugan, discuss.
Yikes. Well, I think Donner's films hold up a little better than that. Donner also
They do.
Yes. Yeah. Donner also was directed an episode of the original Star Trek, as did John Erman, whose death was just announced today, although apparently he passed away a couple weeks ago.
Right.
John Erman, 85, only made one theatrical feature, but did a ton of TV, like directed episodes of or chapters of Roots and Roots the Next Generation. He did that made for TV Streetcar Named Desire with Treat Williams and Anne Margaret. Did another Anne Margaret film called Who Will Love My Children that he won an Emmy for.
Mm-hmm.
And then did like these incredible breakthrough films when it comes to like LGBT content and a made-for-TV movie. In the mid-70s, he did a film called Alexander, The Other Side of Dawn, which I think we devoted an entire LKTV episode to.
Right.
Which was a sequel to a movie that Eve Plum had starred in called Dawn, Portrait of a Teenage Runaway.
Yeah.
She gets involved with this guy, Alexander, who it turns out is also a sex worker. And then he got a sequel that was all about him. And it was very, like... For mid-70s network TV...
Very pro-gay.
Very pro-gay. He gets into, like, a fairly lengthy relationship with another guy.
Yeah.
You know, they shot part of it on the John Retchie steps, mm-hmm. on the steps of that church in Hollywood.
The Baptist church.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that was, like, way ahead of its time. And then a decade later, he did An Early Frost, which was the first TV movie to deal with AIDS at all, with Aidan Quinn and Jenna Rollins. He did Our Sons with Anne Margaret and Julie Andrews. And I want to say Hugh Grant was one of the sons.
Mm-hmm.
So those were like really early out of the gate, like mainstream TV efforts to talk about HIV AIDS in a sort of non-hysterical and compassionate context.
I double checked. Yes, Hugh Grant was one of the sons.
I thought so.
Yeah.
And then he also directed one of his, like his, I think, next to last credit is a film that I have been trying to... I've been beating the drum for a very long time, and I continue to do so. So it was a Hallmark Hall of Fame that he did called The Blackwater Lightship.
Back when the word Hallmark didn't mean crap.
Yes.
Or rather, it meant... right now it means crap. Because they ain't crap. But now it means... No. Then...
What are you saying?
I don't know.
Hallmark Hall of Fame
was... Used to mean something good.
Yes.
Is really what I'm trying to get at here.
Back in the day before prestige television, Hallmark Hall of Fame was like, okay, we're gonna class things up for a
They were
here.
Prestige television.
They were prestige television. So it's based on a novel by Colm Tóibín. It's about an Irish gay guy in his early 30s, I want to say, who is in the final stages of AIDS complications. And tending to him are his sister, played by Gina McKee, his mother, played by Diane Wiest, and his grandmother, played by Angela Lansbury.
Right.
And these three women have various sort of familial contentions and whatnot that play out over the course of you know, the final days of this guy that they all love and are related to. Diane Wiest has a final speech in this movie with Gina McKee that I'm tearing up just talking
about. You're
just
thinking about it.
It is such an amazing moment and like one of the pinnacles of her extraordinary acting career.
Wow.
Wasn't in a theatrical film, but I'm telling you, I think it's on Amazon Prime, Blackwater Lightship. If you get Hallmark movies now, I think it's always on the you know, there's a section they have for Hall of Fame stuff.
You mean the streaming channel called
Hallmark Movies Now.
Yes. Okay.
Anyway, so John Erman, like, and Richard Donner, both very big deals, both gone.
You want to talk about the Forever Purge now?
Sure. Not to be confused with the Tomorrow War, which we're also talking about.
The Forever Purge is the latest of the Purge movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know what a big fan I am.
I know you are.
Of that, all the purging.
Yes.
This one is set in Texas.
Yes.
And, you know, it's annual Purge night. Everyone's locking down their stuff. And a racist ranch guy, played by Josh Lucas, is, you know, closing up shop for the day and et cetera. Meanwhile, some of his employees, who are Mexican, they are sort of scrambling for a place to go for the night.
Finding shelter in a church.
Yeah. And they go to this church. Purge passes uneventfully. They get up the next morning and boom, it's still a purge.
Yeah.
Turns out that's some MAGA style people.
Some very armed and very racist folks have decided that the purge is not ending.
Right. They're going to keep it going because they don't want to live among not white people anymore. Right. And they want to get rid of all of them. And as we've learned over the course of the many Purge films, it has become an evening engineered to...
By the ruling class.
Yeah, by the ruling class, by rich white people, to eliminate as much of the poor population and population of color as it can possibly get to. So now these, again, these MAGA kind of folks have decided, well, let's just keep it going. Which the purge never ends.
Yeah.
Logistically, as we all would understand, you know, in real life, this could be, this would not be possible because at some point you just have to go to the grocery store, you know.
But there are countries that are like constantly, you know, besieged.
At war.
And
yeah,
at
but
war.
But it's not.
But yeah, they have ceasefires.
The purge is utter chaos around every corner of every neighborhood.
True.
In the country, as it's been, you know, set up in these films.
Yeah.
So, irritatingly enough, it is the poor people, it is the people of color, it is the people of the employees of the rancher who have to jump in and try to save the day so that the rancher and his family can learn to stop being racist.
Yeah. Ana de la Reguera, who was in Army of the Dead,
yeah,
she works in like a meat processing plant.
Yes,
and her husband Juan is like one of the best of the ranch hands, played by Tenoch Huerta.
Yes,
and so they're both undocumented. They're both like, you know, they're sort of the moral center of the film.
Yes,
but sadly they are not the dramatic center of the film.
That is correct.
That goes to Josh Lucas and his dumb growth.
Yeah. And the whole time I was thinking, well, okay, I guess Josh Lucas is going to die at the end of this movie because that's what he deserves. That's what you get. Anyway, what instead you get is a cliffhanger-y kind of ending suggesting there will be yet another Purge film. Am I losing steam in my enthusiasm for these films?
You tell me.
Yes.
Okay. Because I sat out 2 and 3. I didn't see Anarchy. I didn't see Election Night. But I thought the first Purge, which is the fourth one.
Yeah, and the Frank Grillo one, whatever that one was called.
That was Anarchy.
Anarchy, right.
Now, and I've heard some people say that all the best stuff in the first Purge just feels like it's a retooling of what was in Anarchy. Do you think that's...
I would disagree.
Okay.
Yeah.
Haven't seen Anarchy, so I can't say either way. But I thought the first Purge was interesting, and these movies are never afraid to be, like, as zeitgeisty as possible.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
If you'll recall, the posters for the first Purge were, like, red caps with white stitching that just said, the first Purge.
Yes.
Like, they're not...
They're not afraid to really give you what they think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
These are barely metaphors at this point. and so, yeah, I think on the heels of January 6th, which happened 6 months ago, and we still haven't had, like, the answers
any
that we
kind
need.
Of legal reckoning for it. Yet.
We haven't had legal reckoning. We haven't had a commission. We don't know who gave... those people maps of the inside of the Capitol, or who disabled the panic buttons, or why the National Guard didn't respond fast enough, you know. So, again, this movie is...
It was that garbage ex-president of ours.
Well, obviously, yes. Yeah. But the details we need to know so that it doesn't have... Because otherwise, you know, as they say, a failed coup is a dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
Unless you, like, you know, really...
Squash them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So... Timeliness wise, this movie is on the button because, you know, it's a film about, like, discontented racists who have lots and lots of guns at their disposal, deciding that the laws no longer apply to them.
Yeah. And I can't tell if the movies are becoming too same-ish for me or if real life has taken the
sting.
The junk food based thrills out of these films for me.
Hmm. Yeah, it's like why I stopped watching House of Cards.
Well, yeah. And it's got me thinking about F9 from last week. Mm-hmm. I was having a conversation with my friend Robbie. And he said, yeah, I'm going to go, you know, but, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, these big, giant, hollow sort of
spectacles,
entertainment machines. Mm-hmm. I'm like losing my taste for them. They used to come along and I would take them for what they were. Now I'm speaking for myself. Mm-hmm. They would come along and I would take them as what they were and review them here on the show with you or, you know, for whoever was paying me to write about it. And I would say, well, for what this is what's good about it. This is what's not so great about it.
But sure.
Here's why it exists. You know, what could we learn about ourselves from the existence of this cinema?
Offering
film and
movie film for theaters.
I think in the case of this franchise, which mm-hmm. is admittedly a much smaller, more niche kind of franchise than
Fast and Furious
films, I think creatively, once you run out of steam, once you've exhausted your ideas, creatively. But the marketplace demands another one.
Right.
And all you can think of to do is just get bigger. There will at some point become a contracting.
Well.
There will be a contraction at some point. Yeah. And I'm wondering, you know, what will drive that? Because as much as I pretty much enjoyed F9,
mm-hmm.
and sort of havesies enjoyed this one.
Yeah.
I can't say that either one of them is sticking with me, that I would be overly enthusiastic about recommending either one of them to anyone.
Right. Well, next week we're going to talk about Black Widow.
Yeah.
Which I think is a way that a franchise is like, what if we like cool our jets for a second. Mm-hmm. And what if having the stake of the entire universe, we just focus on like one character
right.
dealing with very terrestrial concerns.
Yeah.
Our good friend and devoted listener, Dr. Steve on Twitter, responding to Maximum Film was saying that he thinks the future for the Fast and the Furious franchise, at least for a couple of installments, is to go smaller. Like, do stuff along the lines of Hobbs and Shaw, but like splinter off other characters. Well,
Hobbs and Shaw wasn't small, though.
Well, that's true. Know. But like, you know, send Letty and Mia out on the NASCAR circuit, you know, with Tej and Roman as their, you know, pit crew or something.
Right.
Like, figure out a way to sort of like, you know, play with the pieces and not the entire set.
make Mia a NASCAR driver.
Stranger things have happened.
I think it could be cool.
In this universe.
I'd be happy.
Brian will still be at home with the kids.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, because he doesn't want to do anything anymore.
No. You're right. I mean, I think with a lot of these series, like you can't eat cotton candy every day. And so it's like if it stops being this like sort of special, you know, I'm watching all these sort of regular, you know, movies and then this big giant, you know, entertainment palooza lands in my lap. It's like, right. Whoa, that was crazy. But if all you're getting are like these big, you know, epic things, then it's like, I don't have my mouth can't taste this anymore
right.
because it's all you're giving me.
Right. Hey.
Hey.
Amber Petty has a free workshop.
Does she now?
Start writing, you guys. Start writing with Amber Petty.
Write like the wind.
There's a 60-minute Zoom that she's going to conduct. It'll help you go from maybe I'll write someday to I just got paid to write about podcasts. Someone doing that? Someone paid?
Someone must be.
Maybe. Even if you have no previous experience, learn how to start freelance writing and get actual writing done in the class while you're taking it. Plus, Amber will share her story about how she got a byline in the New York Times which involves both Snooki and Columbo.
Well.
So you know it'll be fun. The first workshop is this Thursday, July 8th at 5:30 p.m. Pacific, if that's not a good time for you. There are also dates this coming weekend and next week to choose from. Sign up for free at amberpetty.com/linoleum. There is no code required. That is Amber Petty, AmberPetty.com/linoleum.
Excellent. Speaking of empty spectacle, I watched The Tomorrow War on Amazon.
Great. You have 3 minutes. I'm timing you. Go.
Okay, so aliens invade.
I didn't watch it.
They are decimating humanity 30 years in the future, so they time travel back to make middle-aged people who would have died before the alien invasion go fight the aliens. And Chris Pratt is a former special forces guy who's now a science teacher who gets called into service. And this movie's so dumb.
What happens?
Anyway, then there's a lot of jumping back and forth in time and figuring out, like, you know, if we can't defeat the aliens, then maybe we can defeat them now. And it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, which it does not need to be. It is utterly shallow. You know, like, Betty Gilpin is in it and they give her nothing to do. It's that kind of movie.
Well,
you
that's
know,
a crime.
We get some moments with J.K. Simmons.
Yep.
We get some moments from Mary Lynn Rashkub.
Yeah.
We get some moments with Sam Richardson, who's very funny. Apparently, he's also in that werewolf movie that people keep telling me to watch. So he's having a moment, but yeah, it feels like the kind of movie that a studio is kind of like, oh, gee, I guess we're going to just premiere it on streaming. What with things being as the way they are now,
right?
You know, but like with a secret sense of relief, like, you know,
we were really looking to dub this one anyway.
Know, Disney was like, oh, what? There's a pandemic. Sorry, Artemis Fowl. You're going straight to the streamer. This was like a big Paramount movie, but it's so dumb and so, like, just, it's a big ball of nothing.
How's Chris Pratt?
What's
he doing?
Also a big ball of nothing. Like, he's not particularly funny. He's not particularly anything. In the last 20 to 30 minutes, the movie gets so absurd that it's like giggle worthy, but it's not worth it to endure everything to get to that part.
Great. I never have to think about it again.
Nope.
But I am going to think about Zola.
Oh, yeah.
If anyone doesn't know what this film is, I'm now going to do my best to break it down for you. I think that before you see Zola, you should go to the internet and Google Zola original tweets and read them. This film is based on a 148 tweet thread.
And an article written about
it. And an article that was then written about that 148 tweet thread. The article was in Rolling Stone. I read the tweets after seeing the film, and it really clarified a bunch of stuff for me. But honestly, you could do it either way.
I have not yet read the tweets, and I still, you know.
But the original tweets were from a young woman nicknamed Zola, who was a waitress and a stripper in Detroit. She meets and she's black, and she meets a young white woman at the restaurant who they immediately sort of hit it off. And the young white woman says, hey, I'm driving to Florida for the weekend to strip and to make a lot of money. Do you want to do it too? And Zola says, yes. And what happens after she says yes is, it's like if What's Up, Doc were terrifying. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, if What's Up, Doc weren't funny I mean, this is actually something of a comedy.
It's a screwball tragedy in a way. Yeah.
And it all really happened.
Yes.
In fact, what really happened is more than what you see in the film.
Right. You were telling me.
And it's stuff I can't talk about on the microphone because we are a clean podcast.
That's right.
But what eventually happens is they wind up involved with some very bad people who threaten their lives.
Principally one played by Colman Domingo, who is one of my favorite actors right
now. And I don't think I can really even tell you who his character turns out to be without giving stuff away. Now, you're listening to me say this right now, and you're saying, hey, I thought spoilers didn't matter. Well, they don't unless they do. So if I'm telling you everything that happens in F9, that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But this movie unfolds in...
the way that you don't necessarily see coming.
Wild, careening kind of way where every new curveball that it throws you, you think, well, first you go, ah! And then you think, oh no, how will they get out of this?
So Taylor Page, who was in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, stars as Zola. And I think she's a terrific performer.
Yeah.
But she's kind of stuck with the straight man role here. Like, she's the island of sanity that everything else is sort of erupting around.
I will tell you why I think that is. First of all, let's be very clear. Her performance is incredible.
Oh, well, yeah, no
as
question.
Zola.
And it's just, it's the least showy one of the film.
It is. She's very reactive
in this
role. But she is really the audience's...
Surrogate
here, because in real life, because you're wondering from the get-go, like, well, why did she agree to go on this trip with strangers?
Right.
Right. But in real life, what you realize if you read the original tweets is that Asia King, that's Zola, that's her nickname is Zola. She had already driven down to Florida like a few months earlier and stripped for, you know, cash it was a world she was used to being in.
Right.
But the folks that she gets hooked up with in this story take her down roads that she's not used to being in.
Correct.
And so if Taylor Page's performance had been, yeah, I know this terrain going in, it wouldn't have been like, you know, the audience
learning
stuff step by step.
I'm not saying anything against her. I'm saying the way the film is structured, she is there to respond to things.
And to cleverly extricate herself.
Well, that too.
From what eventually comes to pass.
And it is very much a first-person story, obviously, because it's based on her tweets. And there's a moment where the film sort of plays on the idea of who's telling the story.
Yeah.
Where they you know, it shifts.
They shift to the character, the young
Stephanie, who's
white
played
girl
by
character
Riley Keough.
Played by, yes, Riley Keough. What I really dig about this movie is that, first of all, it's very inventively constructed.
Mm.
You feel as though you are inside Twitter while you're watching it.
Yeah, Mika Levy.
You
did
hear
the
little bird noise,
and she works the tweets in a lot. I love the part where she works a basketball in.
Yeah.
It just seems like it's sort of, you know, a background noise, and then you realize that it's the score.
Yeah, yes. But you every time one of the original tweets is sort of referenced, you hear a bird go boop boop, like a cuckoo clock.
Yeah,
and it is. It is a film that is born from the internet and feels very immediate, like the response that you would get if you were actually tweeting or reading tweets, reading comments, reading rebuttals to tweets by other tweeters.
Right.
And so I in that way, not only is it a sort of like a fun, fresh kind of filmmaking from Janisha Bravo, who made Lemon.
Janixa, as it turns out. I thought it was Janisha, too.
Janixa.
Yeah.
I did not know how to say her name, and I just was going with the letters as I thought they were.
Yeah, Christy said
I thought
that
Janisha.
Yeah, she actually, I think, did a Q&A with her. It's like, Janixa.
Janixa Bravo. Okay, so.
Who did a film called Lemon a few years ago.
Yes. With her then-husband, who is...
Brett Gelman.
Okay. Now I need to go back and watch Lemon, because this was... very cool filmmaking.
Yeah.
It's very much a...
assured.
A thing like, you know, here I am. This is what I can do. Follow me to the next place I'm going to go.
Yeah, she co-adapted it with the playwright Jeremy O'Harris, who had a show called Slave Play that was very, you know, much talked about during its New York run.
And while I was watching it, in the back of my head was, you know, a bunch of questions. Like, A, how much of this is real? Turns out, all of it. B,
if anything, it's dialed down.
Are we voyeurs here? And I am of the opinion that the filmmaking is very much on the side of and empathetic toward not only Zola, the character, but also to Riley Keough's character. In spite of the fact that Riley Keough's character is both a villain
and a victim,
she is the one who is the most, I think, trapped in the story, because she's sort of like the lure.
Right.
To bring Zola into this incredibly difficult, dangerous weekend. But she's also without a choice.
Right. I think that there's a definite, you know, female gaze, both visually and narratively, in terms of dealing with both the stripping and the sex work.
Yeah. Anyone else making this movie, I think, would have maybe turned it into a, can you believe what these, you know, strippers and sex workers are doing.
Right.
It doesn't feel that way when you're watching it. So.
And I want to give a shout out to Nicholas Braun, who plays Stephanie's boyfriend, his hapless boyfriend. He does great doofus here. And he's a character actor I've liked for a long time and is on Succession, which I haven't watched yet.
Right.
I know people love that show, but there's just too much TV.
There is too much TV. I like this a lot. I would watch it again because now I know where it's going and I want to look at it.
Sure. Yeah.
From the angle of a person who isn't holding his breath.
Yes.
Because honestly, I was doing that a lot.
Yeah.
Thinking, please get away, get out of that.
You just have to keep thinking, well, she wrote the tweets, so she must have gotten out okay.
She wrote the tweets, so she lived.
But what else happens?
Yeah. It's a wild ride.
Yeah.
All right. Go with I Carry You With Me, the film that I have not yet seen, but am stoked to see based on your reaction to it, which was a puddle of tears.
Yes.
Yes.
So I Carry You With Me is the narrative debut of an acclaimed documentary filmmaker named Heidi Ewing. She did the great film Jesus Camp. And we open in modern day New York City. There's a guy on the subway. He's a chef. He's on his way to work. And he has flashbacks to, you know, sort of years earlier in Mexico. And you see this these two guys in Mexico kind of coming together as a couple. One of them is more working class, and he is involved with a woman. They have a child together. So he is deeply, deeply closeted. The other one comes from a wealthy family, like that own a ranch, but, you know, his super macho father and he have always sort of clashed because, you know, he's a little more flamboyant, as they used to say.
Mm-hmm.
And so we sort of see their attempts to kind of like have, you know, a relationship, and eventually the one who's, you know, we're going to find out is the chef, realizes that he's never going to get anywhere. Like, he's gone to the culinary, but, you know, he's stuck being a dishwasher because, like, you know, the restaurant owner is just going to hire, like, his nephews or whatever for kitchen rather than him.
Right.
So he runs off and sneaks into the United States and moves to New York City. And he's writing letters home to, you know, his partner and saying, like, oh, it's great here and I'm, you know, all these opportunities. But he's, you know, painting a nicer picture than what's actually going down. And then the partner shows up. And so the two of them are, you know, they're even though they, you know, they can't go back to Mexico, but they're, like, you know, making it work in New York City. And then the movie takes a turn that I don't want to talk about because I didn't know it was happening and I didn't see it coming and it floored me. But it is astonishing. And it is, the movie was already great before that, and this just kicks it up to a whole other level. It's a beautiful love story and very tied into, you know, how the world is right now, the issues with immigration and whatnot. And I think, you know, this movie premiered at Sundance in 2020 or 2019, maybe? No, 2020, I guess. But coming out now, you know, as we are sort of inching our way out of the pandemic, I think it's even more relevant to audiences because you see these guys, like, having FaceTime calls with their family at home. And, like, right. You know, the chef is, like, watching his son grow up and trying to, like, maintain that relationship and stuff. But it's like they physically cannot go back to Mexico or they'll never get to come back into the United States. And they're building a life in the United States. And it just reminded me so much of, like, all the weddings and all the funerals and all the family moments that people had to conduct over screens.
Yes.
In 2020 because they just could not, you know, it wasn't safe for them to be in the same place. And so, yes, it's heartbreaking in the very specific way that people who are in this country and are grappling with the inequities of the immigration system are caught between a rock and a hard place. But it also, I think, touches upon a thing that happened to everybody last year. So, yeah, I just think this movie's beautiful and heartbreaking and hopeful. And I really am excited for you to see it so we can talk about it more. But, yeah, go see it, y'all. I carry you with me.
And then finally, Summer of Soul,
mm-hmm.
Which is a documentary from Questlove.
Yes.
Who refers to it as a Questlove John, J A W N, which is now your responsibility to go Google it and try to figure out what the hell that word means if you are not from
Philadelphia.
Also,
go subscribe to Movie John.
Movie John,
which is a great zine,
a wonderful zine that we love. That is like. There are zines that are haphazardly produced, and then there are zines that feel like they should just have funding to become real magazines.
Oh, yeah. You know,
like, with glossy pages and stuff. And
it's an exquisite thing you get in the mail.
They are. They really take... this isn't even an ad. We just think they're so great. More care and detail and attention put into a zine than I've seen in...
Decades?
Yeah. So, where was I with this? Oh, yeah.
John.
I'm not from Philadelphia. I don't understand the word John. Mm-hmm. I've never understood the word John. People explain the word John to me, and I go, okay.
It means everything and nothing is the best I can come up with.
This is a film by Questlove.
Yes.
It is a documentary about the Harlem Cultural Festival of 1969.
Yes. Took place over six weeks
at Mount Morris Park in Harlem, New York. And over the course of those 6 weeks, there were concerts and concerts and concerts and concerts and concerts by almost every major black recording artist of the time. Brought together for the sake of, you know, promoting black culture.
Yeah.
1969 was a changing moment in black culture, and included in this documentary, which is, you know, lots of musical performances, you get historical, political, cultural context for why it happened, why it mattered, what was happening with black people in America at that moment, all the way toward, all the way to and including a journalist who, a black woman journalist from the New York Times, who
Charlene Hunter-Gault
successfully navigated, thank you, who successfully pushed for the word black to replace the word Negro in the New York Times.
Yeah, which reminded me of 15 years later, the fight to replace homosexual with gay in the New York Times.
Yeah. And so, amidst all this information that if you were, you know, too young, I was five, to know, is astonishing musical performances by, God, the list. Nina Simone, Stevie Wonder, B.B. King, Gladys Knight and the Pips, The Fifth Dimension, Abby Lincoln, Mahalia Jackson, Sly and the Family Stone, Mabley does a little stand-up.
Willie Tyler and Lester,
yep.
Thank you.
The Staple Singers.
Mongo Santa Maria.
I'm not even getting everybody.
Yeah.
Sly and the Family Stone.
I said that.
Very, oh, did you say that?
Yep.
Okay. Incredible.
And the all this concert footage was shot at the time, obviously.
Yeah.
And Questlove could have just taken those tapes and made a concert film that would have been astounding and breathtaking. These performances are so great. But he takes that extra step and puts everything into this extraordinary context. So you have Charlene Hunter-Gault and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton talking about 1969. We're landing on the moon. Black people are being sent in absurd proportions to fight the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
You know, the inner cities are, you know, decaying and being deprived of federal funding. John Lindsay is the mayor of New York. Like, all these very specific things that tell you where this is all happening on the heels of the JFK assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination and Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy and all that stuff. And so what you wind up with is this fascinating kind of cultural snapshot of a moment, as well as the sort of ongoing repercussions. I mean, you and I were both, we saw this film separately and we both teared up when you see Marilyn McCoo,
you guys,
watching herself performing with the Fifth Dimension.
So you do,
she and Billy Davis Jr. It's astonishing.
They bring out the Fifth Dimension and then they cut to Marilyn McCoo and Billy Davis Jr. Now,
yes,
sitting in a room watching their own footage. They have been married since 1966 or 7. Like, they've been married for almost as long as I have been alive.
Yeah.
And they were both in the Fifth Dimension, in case anyone doesn't know who they are or what the Fifth Dimension was.
They hosted Solid Gold, you guys.
They sure did.
But before that, they were in the Fifth Dimension.
Now, as I was saying to the friend I went to see it with, when I was 5 years old, the only artists in this film that I had any sort of access to were the Fifth Dimension, because they were on the radio.
Yes.
They were on AM pop hit radio singing
Age of Aquarius.
The Age of Aquarius and Let the Sunshine In. It was like two Medley. Songs in one.
Yeah.
And they played it all the time. It was so ubiquitous that I knew that song. I couldn't have told you what a Mystic Crystal Revelation was.
Or that it was from Hair.
Or that it was from Hair, or what was an Age of Aquarius, but I knew that there was something out there called the Age of Aquarius.
Right.
And that it was imperative upon you, if you were going to be a part of the Age of Aquarius, that you must let the sunshine in.
Yes, because it's dawning.
And so, so seeing them come out in these outfits.
Vogue needs to do a spread on the outfits of this movie. The guy who hosted, I'm forgetting his name, Tony Lawrence, who was like a lounge singer, but one of those guys who just gets stuff done and knows how to schmooze people and like gets band A to be on the bill by telling them that band B is going to be there, even though he hasn't even talked to band B yet. And then he's going to tell them that band A is going to be there. He was the master of ceremonies, and there is just like a quick montage of the outfits that he wore to host this thing, and it's just like, whoa, stop.
First of all, there were so many of them.
I need to see what's happening with those sleeves.
Second of all, they were every kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Dude, he had style, and and an extravagant sense of self that would sort of allow him to wear these clothes.
Oh, yeah.
And have everyone be like, yes, we will all listen to you right now.
I love that they also, interspersed with the film, they talk to people who were in the audience who had been there. And,
yeah.
and they're looking at footage and also yeah. getting verklempt about it. But this one guy talks about how, like, you know, for until Sly and the Family Stone, black male singers were the guys in suits. You know, the yeah. Temptations, like all these bands, was the guys in suits, and his friends were the guys in suits. And then they saw Sly and the Family Stone, and we weren't the guys in suits anymore.
Yes. But getting back to Marilyn McCoo. Sorry.
Yes.
When she sees herself, she kind of does this little gasp, and she starts crying, and it so overwhelmed me just with my own childhood memories of this happening, you know.
And she's conveying so much.
And she's conveying so much that I started crying in the theater. And so did my friend. And I guess you did too. We yes. watched it separately. It is such a beautiful film. Such a wonderful, like, meal
yeah.
of information and music and history and just love for everybody who was a participant in the shows. There's a guy at the interview at the very beginning, and you don't know why, because he's not famous.
Yeah.
And it turns out that he was 5 and his parents had taken him, and he had forgotten a lot about it.
Right.
And then they show him the footage, and he's crying by the end. And I can just imagine, like, if someone could show you a part of your life when you were 5 years old that you had forgotten, and they had filmed it, and then you got to see it again.
Well, that's the thing. You and I are like the last generation that didn't have video cameras pointing
right,
at us
right,
our entire
right, right.
lives. Like, a friend of... somebody who I went to high school with, and his dad and my dad were both doctors in the same hospital, and they were both from Spanish-speaking countries and about the same age, so like we kind of grew up together. He sent me a clip from one of his father's old home movies, and not a lot of... This was like I was like 1 or 2 years old. This is the late 60s. Not everybody's doing the home movie thing.
Yeah.
And it's just this footage of like somebody's... Like the reception after somebody's communion, you yeah. know, and there's like a split second shot of my mother holding me in her arms.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Dave, because I had no footage yeah. of my mother who you never met.
Yeah.
And it was the first time that I could sort of show you her in something that wasn't a still photograph.
Yeah.
So I totally get
Incredible.
The impact that kind of thing has.
It is streaming on Hulu.
Yes.
Right
it
now.
Is also in theaters.
It is also in theaters. If you have access to see it in a theater,
worth it.
Very worth it.
Okay.
I mean, I drove across town
yeah.
to see it in a theater. Just having it envelop you with that bigness and that loudness is a wonderful experience.
I would love for there to be like a Blu-ray box set where it's like the movie,
and
but then like all the footage.
The songs.
Well, no,
you know,
not just
in
song.
Their entirety.
I mean the festival in its entirety.
No,
they obviously
yeah, I know
shot
what you
the
mean.
Whole thing. But yes, but or that. That'd be fine too.
Yeah. But
you need to tell your story.
Now may I tell the story?
You must.
All right. I almost tweeted about this. I don't tweet a whole lot anymore because I've just kind of pulled back from Twitter. It's kind of driving me crazy. And I almost tweeted this, but then I remembered why I pulled back from Twitter, because people tell stories on Twitter, and the very first comment from someone is always like, that didn't happen.
Zola.
Yeah, that didn't happen. And so I tell you this story, not on Twitter, because it really happened. And I couldn't believe it when I heard it, but it was real. As the credits were rolling, you know, I sit through the credits. Mm-hmm. Well, so did this older white couple directly in front of us. The row in front of us, the seats in front of us. And the woman in the couple, an older man, older woman.
Like, define older.
70s. You know. Mid You know, like the early baby boomer ages, like people who were maybe born in 19, you know, 50 or 49.
Okay. So,
and were
war babies.
Yeah. They were people who were, you know, around 2021 when this concert happened.
Yeah.
All right.
The Woodstock generation.
Yeah.
Woodstock, by the way, happened the summer.
Woodstock happened the same summer. You've heard all about that.
Yeah.
So, this film is comprised of footage that has not been seen for 50 years.
Yeah.
Hidden in a
box somewhere.
Yeah. I hear the woman say a thing. And I am hard of hearing. I have hearing loss. And so I don't trust what I'm hearing. If I hear a person talking and there's music and stuff going on over it, which is what was happening, the credits were rolling, music was going on. And so I thought, oh, what she just said is stunning to me, but I don't know if I really heard it. So
surely she can't have said that.
I can't respond in the way I would like to, because A, you, Alonzo de Rowley, have beaten it out of me that I can't address anyone angrily in public because they're going to think I'm going to kill them or something. Like, apparently I'm a terrifying person.
I mean, I know you're a kitty cat.
Right.
But strangers.
I am.
I'm a strangers soft, have not seen your candle collection.
Soft little marshmallow. Okay. So anyway, my candle collection. I don't have a candle collection.
I'm kidding.
So anyway, I discreetly placed candles in the apartment to make the home smell nice and inviting for guests. Anyone would do that.
And low wattage bulbs in the lamps.
Yeah, so that everyone feels warm and welcome.
Yes.
Yeah, not interrogated by harsh overhead lights. I know what I'm about.
Strangers don't know this about you.
I understand. Okay, so. But I look to my friend, and I raise my eyebrows, and he raises his eyebrows back at me. And they leave, and we're behind them at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, I still don't know if what I think I heard is really what I heard.
Right.
So it's not right for me to really go off on these people.
Sure.
Because I'm still unsure.
And to be clear, before you tell the rest of the story, I would have totally approved of you going off on this person.
Oh, and I would have if I could have been certain of what I heard.
Sure.
Was what I heard. So we get outside, and I turn to the friend, and I say, I need you to corroborate what I think I heard that old white woman say. And he said, oh, do you mean this exact quote? I wish they had left all of the radical stuff out of this movie. It would have been much better. They didn't need to have all of that. They could have just had the music, and people would be much happier. And I said, yeah, that thing that I thought I heard. Where is she? Long gone.
By the radical stuff, she's basically discussing the fact that
single thing about the movie.
Well, specifically, they talk about, yes, the Black Panthers were a thing.
Who did security.
They did security at the show. And, like, that's it. Like,
more than that, though. The Nina Simone poetry reading and all that stuff that, you know, if you're a baby of a white person.
Right. What I was about to say is if your definition of radical means talking about the fact that, like, you know, the slums are infested with rats while Whitey's on the moon, then yes, this movie is radical.
That's a quote from Gil Scott Heron.
Yes.
Like in this woman's mind, radical means any black person saying anything negative about the United States.
It would have been great if she could have had an encounter with Nina Simone in a grocery store parking lot sometime.
Well, listen, Nina Simone was the person who shot at kids in her lawn, who got in her backyard.
That's what I mean.
So,
By the way, the documentary What Happened, Miss Simone, the guy who edited that edited this one, and the editing I think is really extraordinary
here. Yeah. So yeah. It's not just that generation though. It's not just the older baby boomers.
Oh no, I know.
Gen X, I could name you more than two handfuls of people I know personally from high school that I have since abandoned on Facebook who are worse.
Oh yeah, no. I'm not picking on the boomers here, because look, if you say the words Black Lives Matter, you're going to find those people of all ages who are going to be like, do we really have to,
right.
You know, so. Boy.
Anyway.
But as you said, she was a Santa Monica liberal.
Yeah, a person who bought a ticket.
Yeah.
To come see this movie.
And apparently missed the fact that the subtitle is, or the time the revolution could not be televised.
Right. Okay, so here's the deal. We have a 5-star review to read.
Yes.
And then we got to go. Because I have to go to physical therapy.
Okay.
Yes, you heard that right. I'm going to physical therapy for the first time today. I have had a year and a half of hideous back and leg problems that I don't often discuss on this show, but that's what's going on, and I'm going to physical therapy today. My doctor approved it.
Well, all right,
then. And I'm leaving in 30 minutes, so let's roll this podcast on out the door.
Okay.
All right. 5-star review from... Who is this person? Lil and Vi.
Mm. Thank you both.
Short and to the point. Love this podcast. Always thoughtful critiques of movies of the day. Highly recommended.
All righty.
Thank you, Lil and Vi.
Yeah, leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read it on the show.
We have a Patreon.
We do.
And if you want to be a part of that, you can go to patreon.com/linoleumknife, where you will learn all the different tiers of subscription and all the podcasting digital content that you get based on whatever tier you decide to subscribe at. Subscriptions beginning at $1. It's a treat. It's a bargain.
It is. All those things.
What else do you need to talk about?
Well, you know what? Somebody asked us that rather than have me fire off a bunch of other podcasts that people should check out, that I should slow down and just sort of chew on one every week. So this week, I will chew on Critically Acclaimed, which is our friends Bibbs and Whitney. They do shows where they review current films. But if you go to their Patreon, you get a whole lot of other stuff. You get they've been going through week by week the original Batman series from the 1960s. They've been going through Star Trek. They've gone through films that in one way or another inspired the Rocky Horror Picture Show. They have a show called All the Best, where they review every single movie that's ever been nominated for Best Picture at the Academy Awards, starting in 1927.
Wow.
They do just all kinds of stuff, and we are going to be doing some crossovers with them later this summer.
Yeah, we are.
Which is going to be a lot of fun, and one of those episodes will air exclusively on our Patreon, and the other one exclusively on theirs. So if you really want to keep up with all this, you need to join their Patreon. But even if you don't, you can subscribe to Critically Acclaimed wherever you get your podcasts and enjoy some really insightful and cogent film discussion. Subscribe to this program for free at Apple Podcasts. Leave us that 5-star review. You can also leave positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Stitcher Radio, The Lounge, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean, etc. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on all the social medias, and you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And thank you so much to Blue for our theme music. You can find his work at bandcamp.com/blue, BLEU. And that's she wrote.
Yeah, that's the end.
We'll be back next time with more. Until then.
Goodbye.